Good evening. This is Perry Hoffman, and welcome to our second in our series of mindfulness. We have Dr. Blaise Aguirre and Jillian Galen back with us tonight to lead us further into understanding the concept of mindfulness and teach us perhaps how to do it as well. So I'm going to turn the microphone over to them. If there is anyone on the call that would like to participate and share their homework assignment, please send an email to neabpd@aol.com, and when we do the sharing, we will unmute you for that portion. Also, Blaise and Jillian, do you want to also let people know your generosity of extending this into more than just a two-call series? I'll turn it over to you now. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Perry. So, actually, we're really excited to be back this week, and we will be extending our series and having two more mindfulness discussions. So to catch people up or people that didn't get on the call with us last week. So last week we talked about how each of us found mindfulness, sort of generally what mindfulness is, the relevance to BPD, and explained very briefly how we teach mindfulness skills. And we also assigned some homework. So homework's a pretty important part, just to highlight the homework, because mindfulness is truly one of those things that the more you practice it, the better you get at it. And really, when we don't practice mindfulness, even the most advanced practitioners, you really start to lose the skills. So that's a plug for some homework. And tonight what we're going to do is I'm going to give you a very, very, very brief review of mindfulness. Then we're going to ask, we've got one person, hopefully one other person, to share a little bit about their experience with the homework. And then this week is going to be part one of really going into detail about some specific mindfulness skills and to give everyone some sample practices. We're actually also, I'm going to lead everybody in a practice because we had gotten a question asking for us to do that. Then part three is going to be in a couple weeks, and it's going to be a continuation. So we're going to keep looking more specifically at the mindfulness skills and looking more in depth about how you can practice each one. And then the fourth part, we're going to discuss some other types of mindfulness. The ones that we're going to do today and next week are going to be really focused, pretty similar to the way that we teach it in a DBT treatment. But on the fourth part of the series, we're going to actually look at some different ones, maybe look at some compassion, loving kindness, meditation. We're also going to talk about ways to keep up your practice and give listeners an opportunity to share their observation as and their experiences and talk about some pitfalls in the mindfulness practice. So quick review of mindfulness. We talked last week about the most common definition by Dr. Jon Kabat-Zinn, and he defines mindfulness as paying attention in a particular way, on purpose, in the present moment, and doing so non-judgmentally. So we're going to keep that definition in mind as we go. Generally, functions of mindfulness the goal is to bring into awareness thoughts, emotions, behaviors, and become aware of your own experience with the idea that really when we're unaware of what goes on in our mind, we are often just dragged around by our thoughts and our emotions. And in terms of, I think in everybody's life, but as well in BPD, is that, you know, destructive, dangerous, impulsive behaviors, the things that seem to get people in trouble are all often a result of being really thrown around by what goes on in your mind, so reacting without awareness. And that really the lack of awareness can also negatively impact really important relationships in people's lives, so families, friends, and treatment providers. And then the final thing to always remember is that mindfulness is not about changing your thoughts or your experience, but it's about being aware and learning to really step back. And that to remember that this is actually not something that we're necessarily taught to do throughout our lives. So we look at mindfulness as a skill, as really learning how to do this. So that was a quick crash course on last week, and we're hoping that we can have two people share observations, experiences about trying some of the homework that we assigned at the end of our last hour. So do we have anybody, Perry?
Sorry, except for the one person I have, no one else has volunteered, but if you are interested in being the volunteer, please send an email to neabpd@aol.com. But no one yet, except for our one person.
Could we have our one person?
Yeah. Do you want to do it now, Jillian? You
sure.
Want to go there?
Yeah.
Okay,
let's
give
do that
me
now, and then we'll
so
move.
I can unmute that person. I just have to scroll up here. I'm being mindful about this. Okay, I got it. Okay, that person who volunteered, I think you're unmuted. Can you join us?
Thank you.
Oh, good. Terrific. Do you want to give us a first name?
Mary.
Mary. Okay. Jillian,
Mary, can you tell us what practice or practices you tried for homework and then what you noticed?
I tried two. The first one was brushing my teeth with the opposite hand that I normally use. Very clumsy. I was hitting different teeth, hitting the roof of my mouth. Just a very clumsy, very uncomfortable experience. And the first time I tried it, I gave up after about a minute or two. And switched back over to my other hand and brushed my teeth. And then the next day I tried it again and stuck with it a little bit longer, but I found it a very frustrating and uncomfortable experience. And it made me very aware of how awkward I was and how difficult a task that I thought would be easier than I realized, and it also made me aware that I needed to be very much more patient with my loved one, with the things that they're trying to do and experience. So I wasn't faithful for a week doing it. I did it off and on, and then the other thing that I did do was going to familiar places. I took different routes, and I spent a couple of days going one different way and then a couple of days going another different way. And again, my concentration was, my mindfulness was just where I was going, how I was going, also aware of my surroundings much more rather than letting my mind drift. So it made me much more aware of what I was doing, how I was doing, and when I was doing it.
I think that that's absolutely a wonderful sharing, and I think that even though I've been practicing mindfulness and for a very long time, that's still my experience, just how difficult it is to do something new, how difficult it is to pay attention to doing something new, and also in the work that we do with many of our patients who are struggling with borderline personality disorder, that for them struggling with seemingly new tasks, changing their lives, is as awkward and as uncomfortable as you've just described. So, Mary, thank you very much for having shared that, and we hope that others we'll be able to share their experiences as the series goes on. So with that, we'll turn back to Jillian, who will talk about the mindful practice.
Great. And Mary, really, really wonderful job and great observations. It's important at the end of a mindfulness practice to spend a little time and just notice. Notice what your experience was. Notice how different it can be. So we actually got a question last week around just how you even set up a mindfulness practice. So I'm going to give you some things that Blaise and I often kind of recommend to people. And then we're going to do a little bit of a mindfulness practice and then go through the skills. So, you know, some of, I think, and it makes sense, some of the big questions that people ask about mindfulness have to do with, you know, how long and how often should you practice? And, you know, both of us like to think about it, well, Blaise particularly likes the metaphor, of thinking about it like training for a marathon. So really the idea is that you're going to begin with a short practice with a goal. So you may set something like 2 minutes, and that slowly you're going to increase the amount of time that you practice. So you may begin with 2 minutes a couple times a week, and then you may increase both the frequency as well as how long you practice for. And then, of course, if you're going to do some of the tasks, sort of your daily living tasks, things like, you know, brushing your teeth, you may not necessarily time that. But generally, I think a really nice goal is that if you can work up to doing 20 minutes of mindfulness a day, it's a wonderful thing. And to also know that with mindfulness that, you know, some days it's easier to be mindful and other days it's harder. Some days your mind wanders a lot and other days your mind is much, much more quiet. So the goal is really to start small and stick with a commitment. The other thing to remember is that really, that no matter how skilled you are, you just need to remain committed to the practice. So even if you don't make your time limit that you can commit to every day or every other day to do this practice. And another thing that's really important to think about is when's a good time to practice. And in general, it's a matter of preference. Some people like to begin their day with mindfulness. Other people prefer the afternoon, and a lot of people prefer doing it right before bed. So really, it's really to get to know yourself and to know what time of day you're most likely to be able to stick to a commitment. So that if you know that you're somebody that puts things off or somebody that has a busy day and that you're going to be tired when you come home, it's probably the best idea for you to start with mindfulness in the morning. And other people are better in the evening. So really what you want to do is sort of think about how your energy is when you're sort of least likely maybe in your house to get distracted and really decide. So in the beginning, you actually may want to try practicing different times of day and get a sense of what's actually going to be best for you, and then also to think about just in general in your life, when you've put new routines and developed new habits, which is really what we ask you to do in a mindfulness practice, how have you done it? So really think about other routines in your life and see if that can help you out. And another thing that we often get a lot of questions about is sort of how do you sit? You know, what does it look like? Where do you do it? And I think in general, we're going to give you a lot of different kinds of mindfulness practices. So some you might sit, some you might walk. Some are going to be more formal, and some are going to be doing things like brushing your teeth, driving, in a mindful way. In terms of any time you're sitting and practicing mindfulness, I think the first part is it's important to find a comfortable position. So sitting cross-legged Indian style or in lotus may actually be very uncomfortable. So in that case, you need to do what's effective for your body, and so it may not be crossing your legs. But the idea is to really find some comfortable seated position with your chest open. So you don't want to be crossing your legs or crossing your arms. You want to make sure that your sit bones are making contact with the ground so that you're grounded. Sitting up straight, drawing your shoulders down your back. Some people find it useful to sit on pillows, to put pillows behind your back. And you want to make sure that if you are sitting not cross-legged, that your feet are touching the floor. So you want to feel sort of grounded through the floor with your chest open and your shoulders down, not hunching over. But really part of the mindfulness practice is actually paying attention to how you sit. And in general, we teach most of our mindfulness practices with your eyes open. So for what we're going to do, unless you would be doing something more like imagery, we really ask people to start to practice mindfulness with their eyes open, with the idea that we live our lives with our eyes open. So we should really be practicing mindfulness in a way that we can bring it into our lives. And since we need our eyes open, that would be the way to practice. So now that I've talked a little bit of how the setup goes, we're going to actually do a probably deceivingly simple mindfulness practice. So we're going to do a breathing practice.
As Gillian earlier described, we do want you to be in the mindful position. So wherever you are, whatever you're doing, you know, put down your iPhones, turn off the TV, and notice where you're sitting or where you're standing. Straight back, put your feet on the ground, or if you can, sit in the lotus position. I am absolutely not flexible enough to do that. But make sure your feet are on the ground, your hands are on your laps, you know, and so just follow the protocol that Gillian just described in order to do this practice.
So the practice that we're going to do tonight, we're going to do a two-minute practice, and so also put away your watches, so I will help you guys keep time. And it's a kind of breathing, so it's called ladder breathing. So what I'm going to ask you to do for the next 2 minutes, and I'll tell you when to begin and when to end, is to count your breath. So an inhale is one, and an exhale is one. Then you're going to inhale two, exhale two, and so on, all the way up to 10. If you make it up to 10, which is a pretty difficult task, you'll go back down and you'll start at one. So inhaling one and exhaling one. And the key here is that when you notice that your mind is wandering, maybe to other thoughts, if you become distracted, people are coming in and out, you're getting texted, whatever it is, the goal here is to gently bring your attention back to your breath. So notice your mind has wandered. Some people find it helpful to say, my mind has wandered, or wandering mind. And you're going to just very gently, without judgment, bring your attention back to your breath and begin at one. So really the task here is to notice when your mind wanders and bring it back to the goal that you've set, which is counting your breath. So the goal is actually not necessarily to reach 10 at all, but simply to notice when your mind wanders and to guide it back. So each time you notice your mind wandering and bringing it back, that's when you've been mindful. So the goal here is not to get to 10 or not to have a completely undistracted mind, but to notice when your mind has drifted from where your goal is and bring it back. So let's see. I'm going to found a little nifty app on my iPhone to see if I can do a bell. So I'm going to sound a bell, and that will be the beginning of your practice. So just take a moment to get yourself settled and grounded, feet on the floor, hands open. You can try something that sort of palms resting gently in your lap, maybe palms facing towards the ceiling, and drawing your shoulders and your shoulder blades down your back. And then when I sound the bell, you'll begin, and the practice will be over when you hear the bell again. My bell is not working, so begin. So the practice is over. So just we'd like to take you guys to take just a couple seconds and just notice your observations that you had from the practice. How was it? What were your thoughts about it? And maybe if you have any sort of observations that you would like to share at the end of our talk, we would welcome you guys to share any observations that you noticed with the group. Okay. So that was just a very short practice, though a challenging one, if people are interested in having a breathing practice to use. So next what we're going to do is start to go back through some of the skills that we had talked about last week. And I'm going to start, and then Blaise is going to finish. And we're going to go through them in more detail and give you some ideas of how you can practice these skills in your daily living. So the first thing that we had really talked about last week was this idea of with intention, so that mindfulness is an intentional practice. So we just set our goal for keeping our mind focused on our breath and an inhale and an exhale. And so we've done that with intention. So we are intentionally choosing to put our mind there. So knowing that each practice, each mindful practice is done with intention and that you get to choose, so that you can choose to drive your car on autopilot to work, which most of us do, thinking about our day or how desperate we are for our cup of coffee, or what you're going to do after work and if you can get to the gym, or you can decide to choose with intention to drive your car and just drive. So mindfully driving, if you were to mindfully drive, you would notice perhaps your desire for coffee, and then with intention, you would refocus on your driving. So while you're driving, you might notice that your mind is wandering back to all of those thoughts of work and what you're going to do before and after. And then when it does, just like you did with your breathing exercise, you're going to bring it back to driving. So paying attention to what you see on the road, what you hear, and to each action that you take when you drive your car. So it might be signaling, it may be shifting your car, whatever it is. And then each time your mind wanders, you pay attention. So I think for anyone that has not driven mindfully, it can be a very interesting experience when we take something that's very habitual and we actually pay attention, similar to brushing our teeth, to notice actually what we're doing. And, you know, I think back to what I had talked about earlier is just a reminder that mindfulness is not about having your mind not wander. It's with intention putting your mind on a goal, because it's basically impossible for our minds not to wander. So a way to think about it is that our brains produce thoughts, and that's exactly what our brain is designed to do. So the act of mindfulness is just choosing where you put your mind, what thoughts you pay attention to, and what thoughts you let pass. So it's not simply having a quiet mind. So the question then becomes, how do you practice this skill? How do you practice intentionally doing something? Because I think most of what we do is often habitual, and we get very, very caught in these habits without awareness. So in practicing the skill of intention or with intention, what you can basically do is you can start where you decide to practice. So maybe when you decide to practice mindfulness, you simply remind yourself, I'm beginning my mindful practice. Mindfulness is a new task for a lot of people, so explicitly reminding yourself that you are doing something mindfully. So I am mindfully washing the dishes for the next 5 minutes. And doing this just provides a cue to your brain that you're embarking on a practice and that you're choosing where to focus your mind. And another way to practice intention is by the homework that we assigned last week, which is doing something different every day. And you're doing that with intention. So you're not accidentally choosing to go a different route to work, or you're not going a different route to work because maybe there was construction and you were on a detour. But it's actually practicing this skill by setting the intention to change one of your habitual behaviors. And you can do so for a day or for a week. So we gave lots of examples last week. You can do things like intentionally crossing your legs in a different way, brushing your teeth with your non-dominant hand, or changing the order of maybe your morning or your bedtime routine, taking a different route to work, so all sorts of things. So paying attention to what you do habitually and choosing to do it in a different way and being very, very aware and then taking some time to observe what's different. So the next thing that we're going to do is go through what Dr. Linehan calls the what skills. So what do you do to practice mindfulness? So we had talked about observe. Observe last week, we had talked about putting, noticing and watching your experience without putting words to it. So actually this is probably one of the hardest mindfulness skills that we teach. So it's really the observing is really the idea of just watching and noticing. So this can be an extremely challenging skill. In the context of mindfulness, it means really just watching without labeling at all. So you're really thinking about attending to your experience with all of your attention. And when you do this, what you'll start to notice is that you'll start to pay attention to automatic responses. And you'll find, I think all of us do, but with people with BPD, you often can find that some automatic and habitual responses, especially in relationships, can cause significant misery. And you can learn to observe really early signs of things like emotions in your body, which can be actually a wonderful, wonderful, and very freeing experience when you start to be able to observe and to pay attention to sort of early responses that lead to habitual and automatic behaviors. So you can start to notice things in your body as emotions build. So you may find sensations, you may start to pay attention to your maybe your heart rate, the quality of your thoughts, your temperature. So these can all be very, very important things to observe. And so also to remember that when you simply watch and observe, you can actually quiet your mind. So we have to stop thinking as much. And we just are being. So it's the idea of thinking about a being mind as opposed to a doing mind, which is actually quite challenging often in our culture. So how do you do this? So one of the things that you can do is thinking about observing. So imagine sitting in your room or sitting in your house and observing sounds in your house. So just noticing the sounds without labeling them. And you can do this outside. And this can actually be very challenging. So simply just letting the sound come as a vibration as opposed to saying, oh, I hear a bell or I hear a clock. So another great way to do this is to think about watching a sunset and really entering into the experience, noticing there's changes, noticing that things get brighter, things get lighter or darker, get less vibrant, without labeling them as a color. Another way to do this, which can be a very interesting way, is to lay down outside and to just observe the clouds. So not noticing what shapes they might look like, but simply observing as they pass. Maybe they're moving quickly or slowly, and noticing them in the sky. So without being attached to them or labeling them, just noticing them as they pass. And this is a really wonderful way of turning off the thinking part of your mind, which is often what causes a lot of suffering for us. So the challenge here is to be able to just notice. So one of the other challenges with noticing is that you can notice things outside of you, which is a wonderful skill. An even more invaluable skill is when you watch your own thoughts and your own experiences and be able to watch them without getting caught up in them. So imagine if you can watch thoughts as if they were logs floating by on a stream, if they were things on a conveyor belt, and being able to watch them, to watch an action urge arise within you and to let it pass. So this can be a wonderful, wonderful thing and incredibly challenging when we have busy, very, very busy minds. So another thing to remember is that we often get quite judgmental as we're observing things like our thoughts and emotions, and to really notice that, again, like your stomach produces digestive enzymes, that our brain produces thoughts, and that there's nothing wrong with our thoughts. You know, we don't judge our stomach for producing enzymes, but we often judge our thoughts. And we'll talk about non-judgment next week. But just to notice that your mind is simply producing thoughts and that you can observe the thoughts come and go. Dr. Linehan talks about a Teflon mind, being able to watch them come and go without any action or any reaction. And so watching and noticing and observing is done with all of our senses. So you can watch and attend to things that are pleasant, which is often what people prefer, but you can also watch and attend to things that maybe are less pleasant. So you can attend to happy, you know, feelings of happiness and joy. You can also attend to maybe feelings of sadness. And that actually no matter what your preference is or what is comfortable or uncomfortable, to notice that they all change. That as you watch and attend, each of these things can come and go, and they may return back, but that actually that they all can come and go and move freely, which is a wonderful thing to understand and also experience as you practice this. So one of the pitfalls that comes with observing is that often what happens is most of us, rather than simply observing, have a temptation to do something. So this is an example where we gave for homework last week, is that how often do you have an itch and do you scratch it, right? So the desire to do something comes particularly strongly off when we observe, that we want to have an impact on it, that we want to have a reaction. And this is particularly the case with strong emotions. So the idea of observing with emotions is being able to observe them come and go. Notice that they maybe come and go in a wave. They change, and that we don't actually have to do anything at all. So the task around observing is actually to notice an urge and do absolutely nothing. And when you can pay attention and observe mindfully, so knowing that you're going to observe and do nothing, you're actually beginning to take control of your mind as opposed to your mind taking control of you. And you'll actually learn quite a bit about how your mind works and how your thoughts and feelings work and which particular ones you are pulled more to react to than others. So things to pay attention to around observing. So noticing that it's often the unpleasant experience that we want to avoid observing and paying attention to, and reminding yourself that painful memories, painful emotional experiences, all come and go, and that they will all change, and that it's letting things go in their natural process. So reminding yourself that when you're paying attention to these things, that these things change, that they will not last forever, and that there is an end in sight. Because often what happens is that we don't want to observe those. And when we don't observe those and we suppress them, we unfortunately only increase the pain and increase the suffering that is associated with those painful emotions or painful experiences. So also to remember around mindfulness, part of the goals of mindfulness is to be able to step back. So in observing, we say to step back and observe. So the idea is to remind yourself when you're observing that you are watching and attending to an experience and that that is different than the experience itself. So you can think about it like watching a movie or going to a baseball game. So watching a movie is very different than being in the movie itself, and watching a baseball game is very different from playing the game. So it's a reminder that as you observe and learn to step back, you remember that you are not your thoughts and that you are not your emotions and your feelings, but that you can step back and you can watch these things come and go. And so Blaise is now going to give you some ideas of some specific exercises that now you can begin to practice observing.
Okay, so one of the common practices is that we do on the unit is to take something that has a flavor to it, something like an M&M or a raisin or a peanut or something like that, and then just place it in your mouth and let your tongue roll over it, notice the texture and the taste during the experience, and bring your attention and watch how your experience changes over time. If it's an M&M, as the shell melts, or if it's a peanut, as the salt gets licked off. And notice your thoughts and feelings that come into your mind. If you don't like M&Ms, it might be a good practice to try an M&M, just because it would be different. And you might, for you, it might be unpleasant. For somebody else, it might be a very pleasant exercise. When your mind wanders to other thoughts, try to bring your attention back to what you've placed in your mouth. And do that just for a couple of minutes. For touch, we've already described that, the sense of feeling, to describe, to observe an itch. For sight, one of the things that we do in mindfulness is to really do mindful practices if you've never, ever done that before. And anybody who's seen an infant child, first notice its hand and notice how it controls it. It'll hold its hand above its face and turn it as if it's looking at some wondrous appendage at the end of its body and its ability to move it. It just stares at it for hours. And that's, if we can do that, so maybe just observe your hand. Observe it as if you've never seen it before. What is this thing moving without labeling? So what we do is we move from purely observing. It's also much easier, by the way, to observe something that you've never, ever, ever seen before. So if you think about a rose, if you observe a rose, it's pretty automatic to label it, and the label and the thought of a rose just comes into your mind. But if it's a flower that you've never seen before, you know, the labels don't come that easily. The label of the color might be easy, but maybe it's a hairy plant, or maybe it's got different colors or anything. So it's much easier to observe, and you spend a lot more time paying attention to it. So notice the things that you label readily versus the ones that whereas the ones that you don't. So which brings us to the next skill, which is the skill of describe and or labeling. So the skill of observing and noticing, which can be practiced alone, as we said, and describing, labeling, are often used together. We must first be able to notice. You must first be able to notice your thoughts and your feelings, and then you can learn to mindfully label them. Many find this mindfulness practice a bit easier to grasp. Labeling is a very important skill, as it often the labels that we put to our experience, for example, judgments, which cause distress more than the thought or the feeling itself. So we tend to do that. We tend to say, I'm angry, and anger is bad. And so the labels come quite readily. So just labeling isn't going to be mindfulness, but it is an important step in mindfulness. The goal is to learn how to mindfully label your thoughts in a way that does not cause more suffering. So that's an interesting thought, because what happens when somebody dear is far away, or they've left you, or you feel abandoned by them? So to mindfully label your thought as saying, I am having the thought that this person has left me, and it is just a thought, and that thought then not go on to cause more suffering. And a lot of people don't want to go, especially with borderline personality disorder, and especially around abandonment. They don't want to go near that thought for fear that it will just make things worse. So the important thing about labeling is that you've got to label with facts, like the sky is blue, or the rice is cooked, or the table is made of wood, or some examples of labeling with words. To say, the person is stupid, the dress is ugly, is not labeling with facts. It's labeling with opinions. And when we start using opinions and judgments, we're not labeling with facts, and so therefore not being mindful by definition. Well, the same thing can be done with feelings, which so often get judged or invalidated by the labels we put on them. This unfortunately only enhances the very emotion that you find uncomfortable. For instance, I feel sadness, I feel tears running down my cheeks, my stomach feels hollow, my shoulders are tense, I am hunched over. These labels are all facts and difficult to argue about. Labeling allows us to categorize our experience and communicate them with others as well as ourselves. Put into words only that which you are noticing in the moment. Don't add your own commentary or judgment to the experience. And that is something that not only with people who are struggling with borderline personality disorder, but many, many others do, and that is that they have a feeling and then label it as stupid or as unimportant or as silly or something that they shouldn't be having. The practice of labeling can be invaluable with emotions. You must first use your skills of noticing and watching your emotions by attending to your experience, and then you can mindfully label. And if you remember, one of the things that we notice, certainly in the clinic, is that many people with borderline personality disorder, in particular, have a very difficult time labeling emotions. They're just not, because emotions are so intense, it's like all or nothing, and it just, you know, comes upon them, and it's difficult to say, well, this is what my experience is, because you're already in it, so you haven't slowly moved and noticed all of these things. Consider the example of anxiety and panic. We spoke about this last week. Many people fall into this type of rut or habitual thinking as they experience anxiety. I am getting anxious. I hate this anxiety. I can't believe I'm so anxious. I'm anxious again. This is awful. It will never end. I can't control it. Why do I have to live this way? I hate this so much. What is wrong with me? I can't stand this. And the thinking can go on and on. I mean, just listening to that, just thinking about those words is enough to make you anxious in and of itself. So that here's this feeling, and then you've added your own commentary to it. If you pay attention, as the chain of thoughts continues, the anxiety increases. The alternative would be to notice and label the anxiety by sticking to the facts, which would look something like this. I'm getting anxious. My heart is beating fast. My palms are sweating. I'm breathing more quickly. I feel dizzy. My thoughts are moving quickly. I feel hot. Now, we often get times maybe criticized or something and say, well, that's very robotic. That's very, you know, what a robot would do, just sticking with the facts. But the point is, and what we know is that by being able to do that, just simply labeling, that things will change and often change in ways that the person doing that will find beneficial. By noticing and then labeling, putting precise words to your experience, which is the anxiety in this case, you let the anxiety run its course without increasing its intensity. Being able to notice and then label can also help keep you grounded in your experience so that you don't get swept away by the emotions and all the thoughts that follow. When it comes to awareness, labeling is paying attention and putting words to your internal experience. Let's say, for instance, you're struggling with writing a report that is due tomorrow, and this is universally true of many of the young people that we work with, many of whom are in college or in high school, and they just have this report that's due, and they're having difficult time putting pen to paper. You start to get a stomach ache and begin to sweat a little and worry that you're going to fail the class or get fired from your job. And it gets worse. Is that I'll be fired from my job. I'll never get another job. I'm going to be pushing carts around for the rest of my life collecting cans. I mean, it can really spiral out of control. You try to get your report written, but you feel completely overwhelmed and hopeless. And you say, I just can't do this. What you've just said is a thought. And not a fact. It is not a fact that you cannot do it. It is a fact that you've had the thought that you cannot do it. You must be able to, you may in fact be able to write something on paper even if you think that you cannot. Labeling these thoughts and feelings would be something like, I have to write this report. I notice the thought that I have become anxious about writing the paper. I notice that I have the thought that by not writing the paper, I'm going to fail the class or get fired. It is almost as if you were describing something outside of yourself, as if you were a researcher making an observation on a scientific experiment. It would be as if you were standing outside your house and saying, I am now observing a blue car driving towards me on the road and now driving past me. That is what you're going to do. You're going to go into your own mind and you're going to label it in the same kind of way. Knowing what you think is just a thought, knowing that if you don't write the paper, brings up the thought that you're going to fail the class or get fired, does not mean that it's going to happen. Remember that a thought is not always a fact. And the thing about it is that many people that we work with imagine that all these terrible things are going to happen. And if you were so good at predicting the future, then I tell you what, go ahead and buy a lottery ticket, you know, and make millions that way. But you cannot, because you don't know what the future brings. But you can pay attention to the fact that you're having this thought. And by the way, if anybody wins the lottery, it was my idea. An important aspect of labeling is sticking to the facts and doing so without judging. We will talk about judging the next time, or is that in the next section? But and you will see that many of us judge much of the time. Judgments are shortcut ways of describing experience, and generally others know what we mean. It may be obvious to say that when I judge something as good or bad, that that is my perspective. We don't generally explicitly say so, however. Labeling clarifies our experience in the world and makes it more accessible to people and finding and ourselves with whom we want to communicate. So let us do some specific practices for labeling. Let us take a meal. So the next time you eat a meal, do so mindfully. See if you can use the labeling skill throughout your meal. Begin by putting words to the experience of sitting at the table. Describe using labels. Stick to the facts. For instance, the chair you're sitting on, the plate in front of you, the table setting. Next, move to the food on your plate, the smells that arise, the taste and texture of your food. Now, do this quietly in your mind. Don't be sitting at a restaurant saying, I am now noticing that I am lifting the rice to my mouth. That would be maybe a little odd, but do that for yourself. Just pay attention to what that experience is. Pay attention to the whole experience. When you find yourself getting distracted by things around you, bring your attention back to noticing and describing the experience during your meal. And pay attention to see if you actually find that by doing this, it really enhances the pleasure of the meal. So many of us just put stuff in our mouths and we swallow and we never really know what we've just eaten or done. Another way of practicing labeling is to pick up a magazine that's lying around and open it up to any advertisement or any page with a picture on it. And for 2 minutes, label what it is that you see in the ad. Stick to the facts. And then find an ad maybe that you dislike, something that you would find unpleasant, something that maybe crosses your values. And again, spend 2 minutes and label that ad. And just notice if that changes. You know, you're saying the dress is blue on this one, the dress is red on this one. And just notice your own internal state, whether you find that judgments begin to arise. The next skill that we're going to talk about before next week is the participate skill. So to participate is to throw yourself completely into what it is that you're doing. The trick here is to let go of self-judgments and self-consciousness and become one with the activity. So what you're doing in the moment is all that matters. Actors, dancers, and athletes tend to be very good at this skill. They just throw themselves completely into just acting or just dancing or just participating in the sport that they're playing. So imagine that a Shakespearean actor who's doing Macbeth is sitting there ready to quote some famous lines and all of a sudden starts to think about whether they started cooking or whether they put the laundry in the laundry in the machine, and so it would be very, very distracting, and they'd be unable to perform very well. So they just throw themselves fully into "I am now Macbeth" or whatever it is. Most of us, they wouldn't be able to do it if they were doing something else in that moment. Skilled actors fully participate in their performance without getting caught up in their thoughts or worrying about other things. They are present in the moment in front of them. Full participation in something often quiets the mind, and many people find that fully participating in an activity brings joy and some peace. So often our own self-judgments and self-consciousness cause us suffering and lead us to avoid or not fully be present or aware of what is in front of us. Our mind closes and we can miss very important aspects of our experience. For many people, this can be challenging practice, but yet with practice, people can notice some very significant changes in their experience. So with that, and in thinking about participating, I'll share a couple of my favorites, and that's generally because people don't want me to do them in the open. But for instance, singing in the shower, I have an awful voice, but I love to sing. So, you know, just throw myself and sing. Or, you know, you go into your room and you've got those little dance moves that no one has seen, and you throw yourself into dancing fully and let go of all self-consciousness. Now, if you can do this fully with people watching, that would be a furthering of the practice. So anyway, we have now gone through a set of skills, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to turn over to Gillian so that she can... she's shaking her head at me, saying that...
I think I noticed we have a couple minutes, maybe a time for a couple questions.
Yeah.
You have some of those questions, right, Blaise?
We had some of the questions. Yeah. Let me see if we can. I think that one of the questions that came up is how do you get people, especially if you're doing mindfulness in a group, how do you get people to continue to practice, and especially with regard motivation? Because it's just very difficult. And for many things, is you know, what we've discovered is that when there isn't an immediate response to a skill, you know, then people get disheartened and they tend to give up quickly. But as with many skills, it would be as if we were to hand you a tennis racket and say, okay, go and play at Wimbledon. As with many, many skills, the important thing is to get people to just pay attention and just do it a minute or 2 minutes. If you were to take the marathon runner and say, okay, we're going to start you with 26 miles, well, no one's going to do the marathon then. But if you're going to start with, you know, half a mile or a mile, then, you know, people will slowly build up capacity and competence. So I think that it's important for people who are listening in and also clinicians to start every group with a little bit of mindfulness. And the other thing is to get other group members to bring in their own mindfulness. So not that the group leader would say, okay, well, I'm running this group and now we're going to do breathing, but maybe somebody, a group member has, or maybe give the homework that next week somebody has to bring in a mindfulness practice that they've done. So that would be one question about dealing with motivation and getting group members to participate.
So another question that we had got was a question about wise mind. The question was, isn't DBT's wise mind reliant on a person's effective state of mindfulness? Would you describe how mindfulness impacts achieving wise mind? And as a follow-on question, can a person accomplish a state of wise mind without being mindful? Well, the way Marshall Linehan describe actually the states of mind, so wise mind, emotion mind, and rational mind, are actually part of the mindfulness module. So part of learning about the states of mind demands that you are aware of them. So the idea with the states of mind is becoming aware of actually what state of mind am I in. So you can't really separate mindfulness from the idea of a wise mind. You know, there are certainly times we want to be in emotion mind, and we want to be in emotion mind with awareness. For example, being in emotion mind when you're falling in love is an important place to be. So we would be mindful that actually that could be effective. Other times we may be making decisions in emotion mind that could have significant consequences. Then the same goes for rational mind, and then the same goes for wise mind. So states of minds are things that we are aware of, and the act of mindfulness is being aware of our state of mind. What Marsha Linehan has done has basically named those different ways of thinking so that we can start being informed about what state of mind we're in and if it's effective in that situation. So part of mindfulness is also cultivating your wise mind when you actually need it.
So the final, we'll just take one more question, and that is somebody had asked, you know, I live far away from any major city, and so how can I practice mindfulness, especially if there aren't therapists who can teach it or books where I can read from it. And really, it is a wonderful, wonderful thing because, you know, it's a little bit like saying I live far away from a major hospital, so can I get a heart transplant and everything. The wonderful thing about mindfulness is wherever you are. Once you start paying attention to where you are, whether you're in the remotest village in Africa or in the busiest urban center in Asia, you can be mindful. And the mindful is the minute that you start practicing awareness without judgment and with intention to be mindful. So the practice can occur, and the skill can be developed no matter where you are. So I see that we sort of rushed the last minute. But Perry, any other important questions coming in, or you know, things that we need to answer?
Well, just quickly, I can just tell you a few things that came in. One, a person said she noticed that it might have been easier to stay more mindful if her eyes were closed. Because they were open, she was looking at different objects on the desk and thinking about them, making it harder to stay in the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's a wonderful observation. I think there are practices where it's easier with your eyes closed. You know, and some people choose in the beginning to practice with their eyes closed. You know, other people find that actually when they close their eyes, their experience that they're really distracted by their own thoughts. They get kind of caught up in their head. So I think, you know, it's not a bad thing to practice with your eyes closed some of the time. Mm-hmm. But what I would say is that it's really important at least to do both and just to notice how they're different with the goal of really wanting to be able to build the skill so that you can be out in the world, which is incredibly, you know, distracting and often chaotic and lots of stimulation, and be able to grab onto your mindfulness in those moments as well. So as you build your practice, in fact, the more distractions that you can expose yourself to during your practice, actually the more useful it can be.
Okay, terrific. And I'll close on this note and then an announcement. One person wrote in that her daughter has BPD and that trying to do this exercise tonight gave her more compassion from her daughter's struggles in trying to do the mindfulness skills in DBT. So she tried them for herself, and now she can better understand what it's like for her daughter, who seems to be struggling with being mindful.
I think that we, you know, that's a really wonderful observation, and I think we'll be talking a little bit more in the next couple of series talks about this idea. But I think that one thing about slowing down is because we do things without judgment and without assumptions and immediately jumping to conclusions, that we can begin to imagine what it's like for other people who are struggling with their lives. And it's, mindfulness is often so difficult even for those of us who practice a lot. So so just that kind of attention is just wonderful to hear. So, you know, kudos to that person, and I hope that many other people experience something similar.
Wow. So thank you for tonight. Thank you so much, Blaise and Jillian. This is so valuable for those of us who are teaching it, those of us who are practicing it, and for people who've never been exposed to it. It's a combination in the audience. So I want to thank you so much, and we look forward to having two more. Next week we have Charlie Swenson and Kelly Kerner back with Connecting the Dots. And for those of you who have donated money, we're so grateful, and I hope that other people will join that so we can continue to have this kind of service. So thank you very much again, Jillian and Blaise, and good night to everybody. Thank you.
If people are going to donate, they can do so mindfully.
They can do it mindfully. Yeah, well put.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Good night.